The following teaching is from Pastor Ted Glauser of Lighthouse Fellowship of Pacific Grove. We invite you to grab your Bibles together and explore the Word of God. Now, let's join the teaching.
John chapter 2 is where we'll be this morning. So, continuing through this study in the life of Jesus. I'm so excited about doing this. I really am, this study. It's life-changing. It is to me, certainly, as I study through these passages, and I'm learning a lot. I trust that you are as we go through and look now at the early part of Jesus' ministry. We're going to look at a passage this morning familiar, I imagine, to most all of you in terms of some level of understanding. You've probably heard something about this passage over the years. It's the wedding in Cana. It's the first recorded miracle that we have of Jesus. It's the turning of the water into wine. And there are, as we begin to look at this passage and study through it, the applications just come one after another. It's almost like I just had to stop. where does the list end in terms of the practical applications that we can pull out of this passage? Very, very powerful, very practical for every one of us. Again, what's happening here, we're in the first week of Jesus, kind of what we refer to as his public ministry. He's come from his hometown of Nazareth. He's made his way down to the area of the Judean wilderness and where the Jordan River empties into the Dead Sea. He was baptized by John the Baptist. He went into the wilderness for 40 days. He came back out of that wilderness. And now he begins to meet his disciples, those that are going to end up following him throughout the course of his ministry. And the group is growing. The disciples so far that are identified, that we know who they are five. And that would be Andrew and John, and then Andrew's brother Peter has now also joined in. And then, as we looked last week, Philip and Nathaniel have now also joined. And so we've got this group, and it's probably a growing group, but those are the ones, growing beyond that number, but those are the ones that we have named that are now beginning to follow Jesus. And they're believing in him, but he's wanting to reveal himself more and more to them. And so remember last week, as we looked at that incredible encounter between Jesus and Nathaniel, where Nathaniel's first kind of statement to Philip, when Philip had come to him, was, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" And by the time this encounter is done, by the time Nathanael and Jesus have completed a discussion, their very first one, Nathanael believes in Jesus as the Messiah. And one of the reasons he believes is that Jesus was able to tell this man as he approached him all about his character. And as Nathanael began to approach Jesus, he looked at the man. Nathanael had no idea who he was walking toward at that point, but the individual he was walking toward was the creator of the heavens and the earth, and the one who had fashioned his very life and held it in his hands. And now Nathanael is approaching Messiah, and he begins to explain to him, Jesus does, about his character. "Behold an Israelite in whom is no deceit." He was a straight shooter. God knew that about, Jesus knew that about Nathanael. He begins to talk about that. And then they have this encounter, and he says, "Nathanael, I saw you when you were sitting under that fig tree before you ever came here. I knew what you were thinking. I know all about you." And Nathanael put his trust in Jesus at that point in time. And then it closed out that section last week where he said, "Nathanael, because you have believed, you've believed because of these things," he said, "I will show you greater things than these." It was this incredible statement by Jesus saying, as you follow me, it's not going to stop there. You are going to see greater and greater and greater and greater things. And so what we have here in the account of this wedding in Cana is the very first one of those greater things that Nathanael is going to witness. Now, Nathanael, interesting. Getting ahead of myself a little bit here, but I'll do that anyway. Cana, we don't know very much about Cana. It's only mentioned a very few times in the Bible, and it was somewhere to the north of the Sea of Galilee, probably a little bit to the north of Capernaum, which was a seaport city where Andrew and Peter had their fishing business, but a small town probably populated mostly with poor common people, but Nathanael, that was his hometown. It was Nathanael's hometown, and in the later chapters of John, we see that. I believe it's in John chapter 21. Where we're told that Nathanael was there with the disciples at the very end when Jesus had been resurrected, and then he appeared on the beach. The disciples were out in the boats, and he called to them, and they came in, and he fixed them breakfast. And in that whole scene, Nathanael of Cana is there. I love that. And the reason I do is that we've got this guy, Nathanael, right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, and he says, "You just follow me, and I will show you greater things than these." We have very little information on Nathanael, but we know he was there at the end. From this point, his encounter with Jesus, he hung with Jesus, and he was there right until the very end with Jesus. Consistency in terms of his following the Lord Jesus. So anyway, like I say, I was going to cover some of that later, but I got it right off the bat. Let's pick up in chapter 2, verse 1, and we'll take it verse by verse through verse 11. We'll look at this wedding that Jesus now is on his way to. We read in verse 1 of chapter 2, "On the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding." And so it says on the third day. It's not clear exactly. We're not given the third day since what. There are some different views about that. One of the views is that it would have been the third day since this encounter with Nathanael. It's kind of the last thing John talked about. Might have been the third day since arriving in this region of Galilee, or the northern Galilee where Cana was situated. Might have been the third day since leaving the Judean area and going up. We don't know exactly, but whichever one of those you choose, they're all very close to one another. And so we're still now within this first week of Jesus' life. Interesting, on the third day, he's going to reveal his glory. And so there are many kind of commentators that believe that there's some very strong kind of parallels in that with, you know, the whole resurrection of Christ on the third day. But it's on the third day there's a wedding, and this wedding is in this town of Cana. Weddings were major events. They were very, very big events in these communities. Would have been small communities, and everybody would have known about these weddings. They weren't as much like American weddings today, which happen in the course of an afternoon or an evening. These are multi-day events. When we married off one of our daughters to her husband, who is Asian, the cultural wedding of the on the Asian side, very different. And for the Cambodians, it was like a three-day kind of a process that you go through. And all these different ceremonies, all these different changes of clothing, all these different traditions and things that you go through. Probably about a week long would have been the typical Jewish wedding. They would have feasted and kind of partied and just had this humongous celebration. Would have been a time of festivity and a time of uplifting and celebration. And so it was this major, major event, a very big to-do in a small town. We're told that Mary was there, Mary, the mother of Jesus. Now, not only was Mary there, but Mary had some responsibilities at this wedding. And clearly, as we'll see in the passage, one of her responsibilities was the oversight of the wine. And she also had authority over the servants that were there. And so there are many that speculate that this was either a relative of Mary and therefore of Jesus, or it was a very close family association. In order that it'd be kind of like we have weddings today, you know, when we have weddings and you're going to have your family members or very close connect people that are pretty closely connected with the family play these major roles in the weddings, aren't we? You know, we're going to, if we have people that can do that kind of thing, or know people that can. And so that's what's happening here. And so Mary has this kind of place of responsibility in this wedding. And then also Jesus and his disciples were told had been invited to it. And so again, they're making their way up toward really beyond the Galilee now in this area of Cana. And then verse 3, disaster of all disasters happens at the wedding. And Mary, and her one of her responsibilities anyway, one that we are told of, and it hits kind of right in her lap, as it were. We read in verse 3, and when they had run out of wine, that was a major faux pas. You don't run out of wine at the party. And but they did, you know, and it was like this really, really big deal. And so what does Mary do? But she comes to Jesus, right? And she says, Jesus, they have no wine. The wine well ran dry. And now we don't know exactly why those, there's plenty right up here, guys, if you want to come up, right? Yeah, come on up. So welcome. So anyway, they've got, you know, this problem now, and we're in John chapter 2. They've got this problem now where the wine runs out, and Mary goes to Jesus and says, Jesus, we have a catastrophe on our hands. And whether it was a poor family and they couldn't quite afford enough wine, whether the people stayed a little longer than she had expected that they would and kind of overdrank, you know, what she thought, you know, the calculations, you know how you always go through the calculations if you're going to have a party and hopefully you have enough stuff, right, for the party. But maybe that was going down. We don't really know. But what we do know is that they ran out, and for them to run out of wine at this wedding would have marked this family. That's how big hospitality was in this culture. This would have been a permanent mark on this family. It would have been the talk of the town for years after that. Remember the wedding where the wine ran out? And automatically, you know how we talk. I mean, people talk, right? They talk about people. And so that's what would have happened here. So Mary comes to Jesus. Jesus, we have a problem. Now, Jesus' response is fascinating as he responds to Mary, and they don't quite catch it properly in the New King James. If you go to the Old King James, it's a little bit better. Some of the other translations, if you're reading out of them, will phrase it slightly differently. But Jesus said to her, this is reading out of the New King James, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." Literally, if I were to give you a literal translation out of kind of the original manuscripts of what Jesus said there, what he said is, "What is that to you and me, woman? Why are you bringing me? What does this situation have to do with you and I?" And so Jesus is doing something very, very fascinating here. Now, when he uses that word woman, unfortunately, maybe not unfortunately, but we don't have like a good English equivalent to that word. To us, it sounds kind of cold, doesn't it? Woman. I mean, this is his mother, you know, and woman, you know, what, no, I won't say it. But it sounds very cold, kind of, but it's not. It was a tender-hearted expression. If you go to John chapter 21, when Jesus is hanging on that, or John chapter 19, excuse me, when Jesus is hanging on that cross, one of the expressions that he utters out from that cross, "Woman, behold your son." It was an expression of respect and admiration. And again, we don't have a kind of an equivalent expression or term in our language. But he was not being cold with her. But he was doing something else here. Now, Mary had a couple of things on her mind. And what Jesus is doing is bringing out one of the things that she had on her mind. Remember with Nathanael, when he saw Nathanael coming, he saw right into Nathanael's heart. He knew what was going on there. Now, Mary is clearly concerned with the fact that they've run out of wine. But Mary is beginning to put some pieces together in her mind as well. What a great opportunity for Jesus not only to meet a need that I know he can meet, but at the same time to begin to reveal who he really is, who I know him to be. I'm his mother. I'm the one that heard the angel Gabriel that came to me and prophesied this child. I'm the one that knows beyond any other human, living human being, that this Jesus was born of a virgin. I know that. That was my body that this baby came out of. I'm the one that was with him for 30 years of his life and never once saw a single sin come out of that life. I'm the one that saw that love begin to flow out of that life, the heart of compassion that he had as he grew and as he matured as a human, you know, being, but still being God in the flesh. She had all these experiences. You could have sat down with Mary and she could have talked for hours and hours and hours about her baby boy Messiah, Jesus, and who he was. And she knew that he would have compassion on this family that ran out of wine. He wouldn't want them disgraced. But she also knew this was a great opportunity for Jesus to reveal who he is. I mean, how many times have you been in a situation like that? I know we have been. God, would you just heal? When one of our girls had some medical situations when we were in England and we were praying for healing for her, in my mind, I'm thinking, what a great opportunity for God just to heal her and for that to be this witnessing tool to all these unbelievers, doctors, and, you know, people and stuff. And God, you could just touch her right now. They know we're Christian missionaries. They don't really know what that means, but you could touch her and heal her. And what a great way for you to be glorified. Makes sense, right? Well, he never healed her. He never touched her and healed her that way. You see, Mary is going beyond here and thinking there are some ways that Jesus could really do some fantastic things in her mind. But Jesus, and the reason that we know that he was addressing her heart is his response, "My hour has not yet come." This was not yet the time for Jesus to reveal himself. Now, I love this part of this passage because Jesus knows he's going to meet the need. He knows he's going to do that. He's going to do that very shortly. But what Mary is doing is she's coming to him with some needs and with some motives. Jesus is uncovering the motives. And he's saying, that is not part of what's going to happen here. That's not part of the program right now. And then as we read on, it's a fascinating account because Mary does what every one of us should do when something happens that we don't understand, or we don't understand why God is not answering in the way that we think he should answer. Because can you imagine Mary? She comes to him and Jesus goes, "What is that to me? What is that situation to me, mother?" You know, well, not mother, but woman. And so, you know, he's kind of uncovering this motive that Mary has, but he is not going to kind of be, in a sense, brought into what her ideas are in terms of how he is going to work in a certain situation. I don't know how to say it any other way, but I hope that makes sense to you because it's a very important point. So many times we are trying to pull Jesus into our way of thinking, our logic, what makes sense to us. And this made perfect sense to Mary. And it probably would have made perfect sense to a lot of us if we were in her situation. And yet Jesus said, that is not what's going to happen here. Now, it's very, very interesting to see how he works and what he does do in terms of glorifying himself here. But Mary does what many of us will do, which is to connect this kind of opportunity in our minds with a way that we think Jesus might should respond to that particular situation. So we pick up in verse 5 now, and it says that his mother said to the servant. So this is after Jesus, you know, he says, "Woman, what does that have to do with us?" Then his mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says, you do it." That's kind of cool to me. And so, because what she's doing is, number one, she is accepting his response. She's accepting it completely and fully. She didn't argue with Jesus. She didn't come back and say, please, Jesus, you know, she released this situation into his hands completely. But she knew, again, who Jesus was. She had had a lot of experience, and she knew that while he may not reveal himself publicly in the way that she thought maybe he could right now, that he was going to have compassion on this family. And she goes to those servants, and she just mobilizes them, and she tells them, whatever he tells you to do, you guys do. And so she still had the concern. The situation hadn't changed, but now her ability to solve this concern had been placed and left with Jesus. That's where we need to leave our concerns, are with him. We can work very, very hard. We can work so hard that we become a pile of just rubble almost, where we have no strength left. We have no joy left. We have no peace left because we've been working so hard at doing what Jesus is saying. You just leave that with me and allow me to work in my strength and watch the miracles start to come, and we will have the peace. That's what Mary did. She was a very wise woman at this point in time. She left it with Jesus, knowing that he could. I don't know that she knew he would at this point, but she certainly knew that he could solve this problem that had come up. Verse 6, now there were 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. So very large pots, water pots, you know, stone water pots or clay that were there, and they were used for containing water. The number six there probably doesn't have to do with Jewish law. The purification certainly does. There were some very, very specific kind of ways of washing according to the law that the Jews had to go through before they ate meals, or courses of meals. They would, you know, kind of wash in between the courses. And then just Jewish hospitality also, when people would enter into the home, the foot washing, which we read about in different places, was important. And so they needed a lot of water on hand for that. And so there's these very large containers that have water in them. And so, you know, there's, I mean, if you do the math on it, it's between 120 and 180 gallons of water that are there. And then in verse 7, Jesus said to them, to the servants, fill the water pots with water. And so they filled them to the brim, all the way up to the very top, these servants did. They're just doing exactly what Jesus says. This is step one in a miracle that Jesus is going to perform. It's progressive, as we'll see the steps. Step one, Jesus goes to those servants then, and he says, fill the pots. And they obey him. They fill it all the way to the brim. Verse 8, and he said to them, draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast. And they took it. So step two, draw the water out of the pots. These servants, I think, must have felt a little bit awkward at this point. I mean, I would, because they're basically pulling water out of a pot. And Jesus is saying, you take that water and you go take it to the kind of the master of the ceremonies, the head guy, you know, who's over the whole deal. And so I don't know how what light that would have put them in if they gave him, you know, a drink of water at this point in the ceremony. But Jesus says, you just do that. And they are obeying him step by step. And so they draw this water out. This is step two in this process. They obey. They bring it to the master. Probably felt a little bit stupid at this point, but they're doing it anyway. And then verse 9, when the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, somewhere between the time they drew that water out of those pots and the time that water hit that table where that master of ceremonies was, that water became wine. Jesus just converted that water into the wine. And they did not know where it came from, of the feast did not know where the wine had come from, but the servants that had drawn the water knew. They knew where it had come from. The master of the feast called the bridegroom. And then verse 10, and he said to him, every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, And when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior, but you have kept the good wine until now. This was a watered-down version of what we have today in terms of our wine. It wasn't the kind of 12% plus alcohol content that you have today. It was, you know, very much more diluted, very common drink, you know, for health purposes, but also, you know, that's what they drank with meals and all of that kind of thing then. And so, but it would have been typical still for the good wine to be brought out first and then for the, you know, successive levels of, I mean, you don't buy wine for however many people are going to be there, the just the top quality wine, nobody probably could afford that. But there was a kind of a way that they had, you know, of doing that. You bring out the good stuff, and then as the days go on, you kind of graduate down to the lesser quality. But now this was the best quality wine that had been presented so far, the wine that Jesus had made. And so the master of the feast understands that, and so he immediately goes to the bridegroom and to their family, and he kind of brings that to their attention. And then verse 11, we read, "This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and he manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." So again, this is the beginning of signs. This is the first recorded miracle that we have of Jesus. A sign is something that points to something else, isn't it? And so this was a sign that Jesus was giving. And as we'll see, it was given for a very, very specific purpose. And we used to have, when I was doing engineering work, we had this book for any kind of roadway design that we did that Caltrans, Department of Transportation for California, puts out. And it's a book about, you know, 3/4 inch thick and, you know, a big book like this. And it's a science. The whole thing is signs. They have every imaginable sign. So when you're going down the freeway and they're doing construction, you know, and they've got all this stuff there, those are all signs. They're all coded. They all have, you know, their certain letter sizes and everything. But they're all for a purpose. They communicate information to people that are traveling down a road, information that is going to keep them safe, information that's going to protect them, information that's going to make them aware of things that are coming down the road. And this was a sign that Jesus was giving in pointing to who he was as Messiah. Remember to Nathanael, "Nathanael, greater things than these I will show you." Jesus just converted a bunch of water into wine, and he did it as a sign of who he was, not just to do something spectacular, but for those disciples. And notice at the end here, it's the disciples that the spotlight is now put on in verse 11. It's not the bridegroom. It's not the master of the feast. It's not even the servants, although they knew what had happened here. The real emphasis of this miracle now lands completely back with the disciples, those that were the followers of Jesus. They believed in him. They already believed in him, but the idea here is that their faith now is increasing and growing as they are now beginning to witness these signs that Jesus is doing. So that's kind of the account. Now, there are so many lessons that we can pull out of this passage. So I don't know if I'll get through all of the ones that I have written down, but we'll give it a go here in our remaining time. Some of these we've kind of broached a little bit. But number one, releasing the concern. Notice what Mary did. She completely released this concern that she had over to Jesus. How often do we hold on to the things that weigh us down, the burdens and the cares of this life, instead of releasing those over to the one that can really do something about them? When things didn't go her way, she left it in Jesus' hands. She didn't hang on with all of her might and all of her strength to try to force things to happen the way that she thought they should happen. 1 Peter 5:7 says, "Cast your cares upon him, for he cares for you." I believe that a great deal of the agitated state that we can sometimes find ourselves in comes because we are not releasing the burdens that we are carrying over to the Lord. These are simple applications.